Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Grow Yourself from the Inside Out. Thank you so much for joining us. And whether you're here watching on YouTube or on Spotify or any other sort of venue, listen, my guest is going to cause me problems here. I'm going to tell you, because he's sort of one of the favorite people that I kind of like to interview because of their depth. But the problem, and I was telling them, you know, my mantra in life is that if you think you've been down a rabbit hole, wait till you have a conversation with Kevin. And so with a person with his depth, I can go in a lot of different directions. So forgive me if this is all over the place. That's just how I'm going to roll. But interesting enough, philosophy, if you will, has been something that has intrigued me all my life. I am not not even close to a scholar. I'm not even that well studied. I've read a lot of things where my interest would go to, like things about Plato and Aristotle, and been fascinated by it. And really what turned me on was when I was in the Air Force so many years ago, I remember my first philosophy course, the professor, I think the first assignment was you need to write a paper on the following question: do cats think? And by the way, I'm going to ask this professor about that question too. You know, I kind of sat on the fence about it. I said, maybe, I mean, we don't know yet, actually. But in any event, so, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about putting philosophy into practice. And I know that, you know, many of my listeners are educated. Well, you don't have to be educated, but, you know, have some understanding or maybe even much better read on philosophy than I am. But the thing about it is that when you pay attention to some of the great philosophers and their ideas, man, they really can provide, you know, good ideas for us in life, and certainly ways to grow, to learn, to expand our life, ways of thinking to help us solve problems, critical thinking, all that other sorts of thing. And so we're going to kind of, you know, we've already agreed up front that there'll be at least another episode with my guest. And so what we're going to do is just start off today and just talk a little bit about philosophy. But hang on, it's not going to be the dry, you know, sort of thing. We're going to talk about, you know, really interesting ideas, I think, that we can apply to our life. And so let me introduce my guest to you. For more than a decade, Greg Sadler has kept one foot in the world of traditional academia and the other in applying philosophy in public, professional, and practical context. Based in his hometown of Milwaukee, he teaches for Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, edits Stoicism Today, produces video, podcasts, and writing content on philosophy, and works with clients through his company, Reason.io, and we'll ask him about that. As I said earlier, he's a big thinker. He really is. I've listened to his work. I've read some of his work. And not only that, just has this really deep well of understanding and experience. And by the way, there's one other little thing. I think he's a metalhead. I'm not completely sure about that, but I get the feeling that that's the case. So we'll ask him about that. So if you would, please welcome my guest. It's such a pleasure, Dr. Greg Sadler. Greg, thank you so much for being here with us.
Yeah, thanks for that wonderful introduction. And I am indeed a metalhead.
But there you have it.
You call it a classic metalhead, because there's, you know, like heavy metal with all the different genres that spun off of it.
True.
And then there's like, you know, the stuff that happened in the 70s and 80s. And I'm more rooted in that older stuff. And interestingly, we've gotten to see, my wife and I, a number of those bands over the last 10 years, you know, many that I didn't get to see back in my teen and 20 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Like who? Like, you know, give me one or two that you...
So the one that we've seen the most is Judas Priest.
Oh.
And I'd never seen them as... I mean, I listened to them a lot, and they were one of my favorite bands as
sure.
a teenager, but I'd never actually gotten to go to a show. And one of the things that's really cool about a lot of these older bands like Judas Priest or Iron Maiden or Deep Purple or Uriah Heep is they've got nothing to prove to anybody. They've like, you know, established their bona fides decades ago, and they're just there to like have a good time and keep doing it until they're too old or, you know, too sick to perform. Whitesnake, actually, we were going to go see them on their farewell tour, and unfortunately David Coverdale's got an upper respiratory infection, and you know, if you're 70 years old, you gotta take it easy when that sort of thing happens. But
yeah, don't yeah, tell that to the Rolling Stones, though. I'm going to tell you, man.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're pickled. Right? Okay. So they may go until they're 100 or something.
I know, it's crazy. It's crazy. Well, you know, I never was a metalhead, if you will. I did. There was an era there where I listened to, you know, but I will tell you, even though I was a little bit vanilla, you know, maybe before I got into the Air Force at my first concert. So here's, you know, pretty kind of average guy went to see Blue Oyster Cult, Black Sabbath, and I think REO Speedwagon. And I remember it almost, my head almost exploded, but I loved entertainment. So, you know, the whole laser shows and thing, man, I was completely blown away. So I've had a, you know, a little bit of experience there.
You know, we saw Blue Oyster Cult before COVID. So maybe 2019, and they still put on a hell of a show.
Is that right?
Know? Yeah.
Nice. Well, listen, Greg, I always like to ask my guests, you know, from, you know, where are you coming from today? And maybe just tell us a little bit about your background. I did get to read, you know, a bit of a, I don't know if you want to call it an essay, but sort of a, this, you know, about your life growing up and about your father, man. And I tell you, I started reading it, and I was just going to kind of glance through it and just got glued on it. First of all, your writing is very, very good. But aside from that, you were just so honest and I just appreciated what you said about your father, you know, that you didn't, let me just ask, so who is Greg Sadler? Tell us a little bit about who you are, where you're coming from, and all this sort of thing.
Well, I'm somebody who's kind of come full circle. I grew up here where about 30 miles west of where we're currently living now in the downtown of Milwaukee, and I'm actually married to somebody who I met in high school.
Very nice.
Dated my arch rival at the time.
Yeah, he won.
There's
he got
a whole,
the girl.
There's a whole story there. I'm somebody who, it's weird. I'm now 51, and I began studying philosophy in an academic way when I was 20. I'd gone in the army. I didn't actually intend to like go to college at all. And I went in the army and got out during the peace dividend of 1990 before Desert Shield happened. Well, they were trying to get everybody to, they're cutting people as much as they could. So then I worked in some restaurants and then decided to go to college. And when I got to college, my mom's old boyfriend had said, declare a major right away, because that way you get in with people and you're not just, you know, a freshman lost in the crowd. And I looked down the list that I saw philosophy, and I was like, that sounds cool. I'll do that. And so I just kind of kept moving, you know, forward with it. It was kind of a inertia. And, I don't come from a family of academics. Most of the people in my large adopted family were blue collar, you know, tradespeople. And for a long time, they would actually mix up philosophy and psychology. They thought I was studying psychology. And then they'd always ask me, what exactly do they pay you for? What's your product? You know, why would anyone do anything for you? But I came to philosophy, and I think I'm kind of different than a lot of my peers. You know, a lot of philosophers, they're interested in the little niche thing that they're doing, and they don't really like to talk to regular people. They think they're slumming if they have to teach business majors and fashion majors and nursing majors and people like that. Yeah. But I actually like that. I think you're probably like this as well. I'm kind of a talker, you know, a bit garrulous. So I like talking with my students or clients or whoever. And I found that, so you mentioned like Plato, for example. You can read Plato in a very academic, kind of abstract way that doesn't connect with people, but you can also take these classic works and you can find so much of value to people who are not going to like spend their time just being academic philosophers and apply it to their lives. And I was always interested in that aspect. And so, you know, I did the traditional professor thing. My first job out of graduate school, I taught in a maximum security prison for Ball State University. And that was pretty good. But then, you know, the state cut the grant that was allowing that to happen. So I had to get on the job market, and I went down to Fayetteville, North Carolina, and I was at Fayetteville State for a while. And I was doing like the traditional professor thing, but I would give public talks and I would talk with my students. And then my now wife and I got together. I moved up to New York, where she was working at the Culinary Institute of America.
Oh, cool.
Started adjuncting, started doing more of the video stuff. And that created a lot of opportunities for doing engagements with you know, non-academic people.
Yeah.
And I kind of, I found I just thrived in that. Reason.io, I started as a business basically just so I could use it to get deductions on taxes, you know, when I do speaking. And just kind of grew, you know?
Yeah.
And so I don't have a great, like you asked, well, who's Greg Saylor? I don't have a great handle on that, quite frankly, but I know where I've been and I know the kinds of things that I've done. I suppose I'm not a good example because, you know, you think a philosopher ought to like really have it all together, like have thought everything out and planned things methodically. I didn't really do that. I, you know, somebody would say, hey, can you give a talk on this? And I'd be like, I don't know. Can I give a talk on that? Yeah, I'll do that. That would turn into like a sideline, you know?
You know, but I can appreciate that. And I really did somewhat pick up on that in some of the videos that I've watched with you and some of your writings. And I can certainly say that I have an appreciation for it, but I would venture to say that probably the majority of people, just the average person, has an appreciation for somebody who kind of immersed themselves in life a little bit, did a tour or so with the Army, you know, and then jumped on it. And I'll be honest with you, it was, you know, I didn't get my first degree until after 20 years in the Air Force. So I just got mine, went back in 2006 or seven or something, a bachelor's, and then later a master's. But I even actually walked away from there going, wow, man, this is maybe the way it should be done, because I had so much different way of viewing academia and just the work that I was involved with. But having said that, I mean, you're on the one hand, you know, I would, and I'm saying this, you know, you're an esteemed professor and writer, and on the other hand, you're a regular guy, and I love that.
You know, going back to something that you just said a couple minutes ago, I kind of think that a lot of our students who are pushed into being in college and, you know, at 18, 19 years old, they probably would benefit from being out there and working a while and then going back to college. But we've set things up and incentivized it so it doesn't work quite like that. Because, you know, I get a lot of kids in my, I really like teaching the really basic classes like intro to philosophy or ethics or these things that we call service classes, because you get a wide mix of people. It's not just philosophy majors who are easy to teach, you know. I mean, the higher you go, the easier the teaching gets. Like a graduate level seminar, you just kind of point the students in the right direction and say, go do some research. It's the really tough stuff is at the lower level classes where they come in and they're like, what the hell is this? I've never done philosophy.
Yeah. You
know? And I, you know, I talk with the students, you know, during the class sessions and then outside of class. And I get the sense at a lot of places, not so much at Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. Those kids know what they want to do, right?
Because they're artists and
designers. Yeah. But like when I teach at Marquette University when I was teaching at Marist or Carthage College, some of these kids, they're just kind of going through the motions and they'll get something out of a class, but they might have gotten something more had they taken it 5 years later, you know?
Yeah, man, I get that. You know, I think that's worth, you know, those listening who, you know, still, maybe still have kids in high school or whatever to think about that.
Yeah.
You're right. There is tremendous, not when I was growing up, I'll tell you, but you know, when I graduated from high school, there wasn't even a thought for me to go to high school. I barely made it out of high school, but seriously, it was for rich people or really smart people, the way that I thought when I graduated high school. And now it's expected of everyone. And I echo your sentiments. There's some who maybe shouldn't even go to college. Not that they're not smart enough, but maybe their value is somewhere else and they spend time in college. They don't like it.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know. That's a whole different topic.
No, I think that's really quite important, because there's this underlying assumption that clearly is false nowadays, that I think our generation, it was already starting to prove false. Like, you know, previously college was seen as your entry point into the middle class, right?
Yes.
You go to college, doesn't matter what degree you get, you've got a bachelor's, somebody will hire you to do something. So it could be like communication or business, or pick whatever you want. And then, you know, we started to see with our generation, that's not quite true. And student loans started getting, you know, much more onerous, and you know, they'd sell them off to somebody else. And then with the millennials and now Generation Z, this notion of, well, if you just go to college, you're kind of set for life. It's completely false, you know.
100% agree.
Yeah. So 100% it's,
agree.
I mean, I'm not trying to dissuade anyone from going to college.
But to think twice about it and not just fall into that trap of, you know, I don't know. There's so much peer pressure, I think, behind that. You know, there's certainly, I don't know. Yeah, that's a tough one.
Well, it's peer pressure, but it's also parental pressure.
Correct.
And the parents are making these decisions based on what their experience was, not on what the current economic, you know, environment looks like.
And we all want our kids to do better than us. And so I get that. And I'm with you there. Well, listen, I was asking about your father, if I may ask you that again, but there's really a lot that you wrote there, and I'm going to kind of narrow this down for you in a piece that, that you wrote. I really encourage people to go out and read this, and we'll put them in the show notes and ask you about this, but I want to read this little piece that I just loved that you wrote. And then maybe just ask you to comment a little bit about your father. It's a really a great piece here. It says, for several years, I remember the sound of my dad's voice, and then my recall began to waver and fade. When I realized that I was losing that aspect of him, I began to listen from time to time to that tape. And you were talking about a cassette tape that you had found, sometimes on my own and sometimes with my sister. I should give some context here. I'm jumping ahead of myself here, but that your father passed away many years ago.
Yeah.
And that's what you're writing about. You're talking about your father here. And then you write this. You found this cassette tape. And let me just read the rest, because it's beautifully written. So you say, I began to listen from time to time to that tape, sometimes on my own and sometimes with my sister. Cassette tapes, especially the cheap ones you could buy in bulk pack, then I remember that, weren't made to last, and eventually it began to stretch, which affected the sound what would inevitably happen. The tape got caught, pulled out of its case, and crumbled up, but it didn't break the first time. I wound it up, and we got a few more plays out of it before the time it finally broke beyond repair. And then it went gone for good. Then it was gone for good. The sound of my dad's voice, gone from my own memory, gone from the physical recording, gone beyond any means of recovery. I do remember things he said, the words, the ideas, even the feelings that went with them at a particular time and place, but the sound itself has faded into the past, never to be heard again. I honestly have chill bumps just thinking about it. And before this, you just really talked about what a good man your father was, and the influence he had on you, but that you wished he'd have been around and influenced you even more. So just tell us, I mean, just wherever you'd like to go with that.
Yeah. I mean, he was pretty unfortunate in that he died at only 36, and you know, now I'm way older than he was. And he packed in so much living. I mean, he was a super hard worker. That's something that I think that comes out in the piece. But he made a lot of time for my mom and for the family in general and for us kids. And, you know, he wasn't perfect. I mean, he'd get angry sometimes. He also would tease us, which we didn't like. It was his way of, you know, relating to us, I think. But on the whole, he was a really good guy. He actually, you know, he took a job that I mentioned this in the piece as well, closer to where we were, so he could spend more time with us. And then he found out that they were cooking the books. He was the chief accountant, and he decided to, instead of like going along with it, he took a stand and quit the job and had to go back to the law firm that then sent him down to start an office in Houston. And yeah, there were so many things that we tried to hold on to about people or even pets that have died. You know, recently we lost our cat Sassy, who was 19 years old. I was closer with her than I've been to any other animal in my life. And, you know, we still have her cat bed that sits somewhere with the blanket and her little mouse and stuff. So
it's extraordinarily heartbreaking, isn't it? When a pet passes, it's hard to even put words behind it.
And it's, you know, to go to that thing that you started with at the beginning, do cats think? I would say absolutely. I mean, you can look at them and see them thinking, and dogs do too, and pigs and elephants and, you know, higher animals. You can see like from the expression on their face that they're pondering something. They don't think the way we do, obviously. And I think that there's whole ranges of things that they don't really care about like we do. But, you know, affection, closeness. I became so much Sassy's person that apparently when I would go off to teach, she would wander around and she would make a special cry that she didn't do for anything else, you know, like, and my wife interpreted it basically as like, where the hell are you? So there's all that. And there's, you know, as we go through life, we're inevitably going to encounter a lot of loss and grief because everybody, either they die before we do, or we're going to die before they do, or we'll die at the same time, but everyone's going to die, you know, and every pet's going to die. So, you know, we have, you know, a lot of people, I think, kind of push it away and stuff it down or just try to deal with the aftermath in terms of like, well, we gotta do the funeral and we've gotta you know, do whatever we're gonna do in terms of, some people suggested you should get a new cat, you know, that'll get you over the grief. And I was like, why the hell would I want to do that, you know? I'd just like to like think about the attachment that I still am able to have within myself.
And
I think that to go back to my dad, we can say that about the people who count for us, that, you know, we can keep them in our hearts, and it's not quite the same thing as having them present. But and this is actually interesting because this is something where philosophers throughout time have talked about this sort of thing. The image of a person within our heart or mind isn't just like a copy. It allows for a kind of relationship to continue.
Oh, interesting.
You know, and so like Saint Anselm, when he's writing to his good friend Gundulf, he talks about preserving this image of him in his heart. Anselm is in Canterbury, Gundulf is way the hell up north in York. They can't see each other very often, but they were very close. And so, you know, the letters only allow, it'd be sort of like us emailing once every couple months or something. But this possibility of keeping a vivid image of somebody else in your heart allows you to continue the relationship. But to go back to the sound thing, we lose certain aspects. I don't remember what my dad sounds like, and I don't remember what my mom, who died back in 2000, I don't remember what she sounds like either. But I can remember the effects that they had on me and the decisions they made and things along those lines.
And I think all of that is so important that I don't know, all of us reconcile or hold on to or blend into our lives, you know, what these people meant to us, whether it was a good relationship or a bad relationship. It's in my way of thinking, such an important aspect of our lives that if we just push it away, there's nothing gained there. Either you're not able to hang on to that beautiful feeling that you had about your parents, or that you don't recognize, you know, maybe even some of the good that came out of a bad parent, you know, You know, I tell it all the time how tough my dad was, and I resented it for a long time, but it's made in part who I am today, and the good parts of me, you see.
Yeah, and I think that the relationship can change, you know. Remembering my dad when I was 18 is very different than remembering him when I'm much older than he was when he died. You know, like you said, that you can have a relationship that either is a bad relationship or has bad aspects to it, and you can work that through.
Yeah.
So instead of just memorializing the person and, like, you know, setting them up on the pedestal, oh, my dad was so amazing, so wonderful, blah, blah, blah. Right. You can say, yeah, he was a good guy, but, he did this thing over here, like the teasing thing. I told my wife about that, and she would point it out when I did it with my own kids.
Interesting.
And then, you know, I had to make a deliberate effort to rein that in, because I had that, you know, mostly good modeling, but bad on that point. That was ticking them off, just like I'd get ticked off when I was a kid.
Right. You know? Right. No, that's
so interesting. So there's lots of things we can do in terms of, like, working through. I mean, you could have somebody who's, like, kind of a bad person, more bad than good in your life. And, you know, they still mattered to you because they were your family member or something. Yeah. And they die, and you work through the stuff that was detrimental or bothering you or damaging, and you change the nature of the relationship over time by doing that. You know,
You know, my late mother-in-law, she, matter of fact, passed away last July at 94, and wow, she was a true matriarch, and she just impacted so many lives, including mine, for, you know, the 30 something years that I knew her. And I remember the one thing that she told me, speaking of philosophy, I mean, she was just like this great philosopher in her own way. I mean, when we would go visit them up in Moline, Illinois, was almost, you know, it's not too far from where you're at. You know, it was almost like every morning it was like a race to get upstairs, because we would, like, stay downstairs in their house. It was a race for a number of people to get upstairs and get some quiet time with Nancy. Because you just knew it was going to be this beautiful moment of conversation about life and whatever. But she told me one time, and you know, well, it doesn't matter, I'll just say it. She said to me, we were just talking about, you know, difficult people, and she, you know, and she was very, very forthcoming about her thoughts, and, you know, talking about, sometimes I judge people and I know I shouldn't. And we just got into that whole conversation. And she said this to me, she said, Kevin, you know what? But it came to me probably too late in life, that when I look at people, I should remember that each of them are children of God, is the way that she would put it, you know? And, you know, and whatever you think about that or religious thing is it just, it put me back on my heels a little bit, saying, you know what? And you can say that in a lot of different ways, that, you know, man, we're all broken in some form or fashion.
Yeah.
Some we can't tolerate. But others, maybe as they pass on, you just think, yeah, you know, I mean, I don't know, maybe they did the best they could, or maybe there was a good side that we wished we could have seen a little bit more. So I just think that was a powerful thing that she said to me, that it doesn't always stay at the front of my mind, but many times if I'm angry or if somebody really pisses me off, I try to go, you know, listen, you got your own shit. So, you know. Don't be too judgmental.
That's true. I mean, like, with people who are kind of casual interactors, you know, like, I don't know, coworkers or neighbors or stuff like that, we only get to see this tiny little sliver of they are. But even with, like, you know, again, parents who've died, like, I didn't get to know what my dad was like as adult to adult. Maybe I did idealize him, you know, in ways that, had I known him, you know, as he moved into his 40s and 50s and I was moving into my teens and 20s, maybe I would have seen things that were not as good.
You know? Very interesting.
But, you know, you get the little window that you have, so.
Yeah, no, that's right, man. I love that. Very, very love that conversation.
You know, I will say one other thing, though, that has to do with philosophy that comes out of, like, you're just mentioning your mother-in-law and the wisdom that she had to impart. I think that, so, like, you know, if I'm teaching we were talking about earlier about Plato, right? So I'll be teaching some Plato this semester in my courses to students at Marquette University and at Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. And we'll talk about the parts of the soul. So Plato had this, you know, three-tiered thing where we have the appetites or the desires, basically, for, like, you know, eating and drinking and sex and laying around and doing all the physical pleasures, right? Binge watching Netflix for hours and hours. And then we have, like, the rational part of the soul up on top, and that should be running the show. Oftentimes it's not, right? We use our rationality just to figure out how to get the things we want. And then there's this middle part of the soul. Plato calls it thumos, and it's the part that gets angry. It's the part that cares about social status. It's the part that courage resides in. And you don't necessarily have to buy into this entirely to see that there's some truth there, right? That we need this energetic part of the soul, or one of the beautiful translations of it in the Philokalia is the incandescent part of the soul. Like when you put, you know, through the old light bulbs before we had all the LED ones, you know, it heats up and stuff. So, you know, when we're talking about this, I'm presenting it to the students and I'm giving examples that they can relate to, and I'm having them think about themselves, but I can talk about it in a way where I'm doing it in a seemingly just purely objective way. And I'm teaching them what Plato has to say about this. Plato's the real big teacher, and then I'm kind of an intermediary, but I'm not saying how it has anything to do with me. Right.
Interesting.
If instead I say, yeah, I struggle with anger myself. One of the main areas I work in is anger management. And it's because I grew up pretty angry and looked to philosophy for resources to help me with that. When you say that to your students, or you know, if you're doing a presentation, you know, to a group or something, or like when I do work on anger management with clients, that inclusion of yourself as, like you said, somebody who's not perfect, is struggling, has gotten some help from this philosophical distinction or doctrine or something, you can see like their eyes light up, you know, they're like, oh, well, it's, you know, this is not just for me as somebody who has it imposed on them. This is being invited to a conversation with somebody who's been through a bit more of this than me, you know?
Wow.
So you could say there's ways to make philosophy, which could be this very boring, dry, abstract thing, into something really vital and living for people. But, you know, it takes work. You can't phone it in.
No, you're right about that. And I do think when we hear the term philosophy, especially if we're in academics, and there's some you know, there's maybe, you know, again, you'd have to really tell me, but, you know, there's different aspects of philosophy, and I'm gravitated to the, again, to the metaphors, the lessons, the understandings, the insights, and don't really want to get too deep into, you know, logic or any of these other sorts of things, you know, like Stoicism. You know, to me, it's fascinating. I don't know that much about it, but I think, boy, there's something really that we should learn for our own practical life about being more Stoic, if you will.
Yeah.
And then there's other things like, you know, I guess Plato's sort of my go-to guy. I guess, I don't know. I'm not sure why. I guess the Allegory of the Cave really just opened my eyes to a lot of ideas.
You want to hear a kind of a cool story about
Please.
Plato? So a good friend of mine who's close to retirement now, he's a professor out at St. Anselm's College, Montague Brown. He grew up in California.
His name is Montague Brown?
Yeah.
No, he sounds like
he
a philosopher.
Goes by Monty, you know?
Okay, got it.
And so he grew up in Southern California, and he went to college. He was you know, kind of a hippie guy. He played guitar and stuff like that. So he goes to college, and he took some philosophy classes, and it was all very dry, dull stuff, the sort of contemporary analytic philosophy. And he just didn't find it interesting at all. And then after he got done with college, I mean, this shows you how much the economy has changed. He could make a living as a busker, just going into coffee shops and playing his guitar and singing. And he did that for a couple of years. And then a friend of his at a party of all things, they're all sitting around and drinking. And this friend, heard that Montague had taken some philosophy classes, and he's like, oh, you should read Plato. And he'd never read Plato before. And he's at this party, and he's like reading this stuff, and he's like, wow, this is very different, you know, this is philosophy. And his friend is like, yeah, that's I mean, it's Plato is like one of the early people that gets the whole ball rolling. And the entire party just sat there and read this Plato book. and then after that, he took it home and kept reading it. And then he's like, I'm going to graduate school. And he went to graduate school for philosophy. And, you know, he got into it as a field that had something to say to him, whereas previously it didn't. And I think the beauty of the dialogues too, perhaps had an effect, you know, we're being invited to like a conversation rather than just being lectured at, you know.
No, 100% about that. And again, I'm not even close to sort of having this deep knowledge about philosophy, but I use it quite a bit, even in my talks, you know, just little aspects of it that I've grasped that I just think about, you know, and so forth. And I'm going to ask you one of those questions. So let me back up just a little bit. This is what I mean. I took you down this rabbit hole, but it was a beautiful conversation. And my first question is about to come out here, but let me just ask you in the most, maybe the most practical, you know, ninth grade way of saying this, what is philosophy? How do you define that?
I mean, yeah, you know, I don't, because there isn't a consensus definition. There's lots and lots of like interesting alternatives out there, because everybody who does an intro to philosophy book has to say, I mean, everyone said, well, it's love of wisdom, but what the hell does that mean? Right. I mean, that doesn't tell us anything. I think that you can talk about philosophy as a literature, right? And then you say, well, what do all these things have in common? And maybe there isn't a have in common thing other than dealing with, you know, big questions or stuff like that. And it's also an activity, right? That's connected. Like the literature reflects that activity that happens, but we can do philosophy like we're doing it right now. And then it's also a discipline that you'll find, you know, in academic departments, but also in other places. And what that looks like changes over time and place too. And, you know, you could think of these as like three different aspects that intersect with each other. And that's usually how I explain it when I'm doing like an intro to philosophy class with my students. I actually have a page that has all these definitions people have given over time. And I'll say, so can you find a common thread between these? And the answer is not really. so it's not a well-defined field, but you can say that a lot of things, when you're doing it at a higher level of reflection, they become philosophy. So there's all these philosophy of this or philosophy of that. So, you know, there's philosophy of science, which a lot of people are really big on, but there's also like philosophy of sport. And it's an area that I don't work in, but I think is pretty cool, where they think about like, well, what is sportsmanship, you know, or what is fair play, or what is the point of, you know, having games. And there's a lot of ethical evaluation built into it as well. And so there's all these different areas. Think about philosophy as kind of like a parasite in some respects, and it gets its you know, tendrils into all these other activities.
Very interesting. You know? So I often, again, just depending on what I'm talking about, I have this, you know, this question that I often pose to audiences. And I ask them the following to get to a point that I'm getting to. It may not have so much to do with the deeper elements of what we're talking about here with philosophy, but I would ask the audience, you know, back in the day of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, you know, what did philosophers do? What was their point? You know, what did they do? And I'd often say, did they just sit around and drink wine and pontificate about life? What did they actually do?
Well,
so I ask you that question.
Some of them did.
Okay, you know, they were probably the better ones too. You know, just
well, you know, Plato in the Republic. It's kind of funny because one of the things that does happen a lot in philosophy is people who are doing philosophy saying these other people over there aren't doing it right, you know. And Plato in the Republic complains about the people who are presenting themselves as philosophers, but they're not genuine philosophers. They're basically BSers, right? And Aristotle.
That's good.
Yeah, Aristotle actually, in his discussion of anger in the Rhetoric, he talks about people getting angry when something that they think is valuable, they identify with, gets disparaged. Mm-hmm. And he says that if they're not particularly good at it, they get angrier. So the people who are into like feeling like they're a philosopher, but they're not really a philosopher. If you attack philosophy, they'll get real upset because it ties in with some insecurity. So there's like a long history of philosophers saying that these people over here don't count. But one of the things that, to go back to your original question, in ancient times, there was like, you know, this kind of academic detachment. So it's, you know, Plato famously says, you got to study geometry before you can do philosophy, right? Which disqualifies a lot of people.
Interesting.
But yeah.
Would me.
Yeah, well, I don't know if the geometry of the time was that tough.
Okay.
one of the things you can say about all the great philosophers and schools of antiquity, and not just in, the Mediterranean and Near East area, but I think pretty much across the world, is that there was always a practical orientation. And so nowadays we use this term philosophy as a way of life, which this famous French philosopher, Pierre Hadot, coined, but it was going on throughout philosophy's history. And so if you were a Platonist, you were not just, you know, reading Plato's dialogues and, you know, pondering the forms, you were doing things that were going to transform you as a person. And similarly for the Aristotelians or the Stoics or the Epicureans, they were all oriented towards understanding human beings and, you know, the cosmos that we live in and figuring out how to take, you know, ourselves as messed up people, both in terms of our feelings and our thoughts, and make ourselves less messed up, you know?
See, so, now this, I love that, man.
Yeah. And it's not like you read the thing and boom, there it is. Now I figured it out. Yeah, it's right. A long process of changing habits and looking at your mindset or assumptions that you might be making that are dubious, and then fixing those over time. And I think it's something too that, you know, we often picture philosophers as like, well, you go off and you do your philosophy by yourself, but this is something that people were doing as a connected, communal activity. You know, you would actually like go and study with somebody and then, you know, maybe check in with them and they would help you out, you know?
Yeah. Very interesting. Are gurus, like Indian gurus, Eastern Indian gurus, are they considered philosophers?
They can be. Yeah. And it really depends, you know, I mean, cause there's fake gurus and real gurus. If you're like if you're a real teacher, that's
okay. Fair enough.
Is,
yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Then yeah, I don't see why you wouldn't be considered a philosopher. And India's got its own vast, a set of traditions, multiple traditions of philosophy, where there's some overlap with religion, of course, right? But there is also in Western philosophy. And that is, there's so many texts and thinkers that there's no like one single thing that we can call Indian philosophy, right? Okay. Same thing with Chinese philosophy, man. It's a huge,
there you go.
Cultural sphere, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's actually a great question, because there's some people in Western philosophy who like to poo-poo that, and they're like, no, you know, only the West has rationality. Those people over there, they've got thoughts, but it's not philosophy. But usually that's rooted in some sort of ethnocentrism or prejudice.
Yeah, I think that makes sense what you're saying. So I'll just ask one more question. You know, would Jesus Christ be considered a philosopher?
Oh, yeah. And you know, George, you remember when George W. Bush got asked that question, who's your favorite philosopher? And he said Jesus Christ, right? And then everybody in philosophy is like, see how stupid this guy
stupid.
Is. You know? Yeah. So I don't think that Jesus was a philosopher as such, but he certainly there's a lot of overlap, you could say, right?
Okay.
Between how he's approaching things. There's definitely like a very complex ethical message that you can see like in the Sermon on the Mount being articulated, or in his behavior, you know, in his engagements with people. Mm. And he certainly, so, you know, one of the areas that I did a lot of work in is this, these debates about Christian philosophy that happened in the 1930s. And one of the participants said, Christ is not a philosopher, but he gives an impetus to new ways of philosophizing. Thinking about, for example,
that resonates with me.
Yeah. I mean, think about the idea of God being love, right? Which is coming from the fourth gospel. In particular, yep. In a very articulate way. So if you've already got like a conception of God in the background anyway, and now you've got this, you know, these new ideas coming to the surface, you have to rethink how you're making sense out of God. So the Platonic form of the good might become God, you know, in Jewish and Christian hands. So yeah, I wouldn't say he's a philosopher as such, but
yeah, you know, and I ask that because, and I'm sure you're much more aware of this, that I think and I don't want to be too presumptuous here, but I think the average person, and certainly I, at some point in my life, you know, when I thought about, you know, if I don't know sort of the classic philosophers or philosophy, I think about, you know, if somebody said, well, you know, what do philosophers do? I would have probably said, and others would say, well, they talk about life, you know? I mean, for me, even the little knowledge that I do have about more of the academic or the technical philosophy, I would still agree with that, you know, to some degree, but I don't know. But I think you've really described it very nicely here, that there's an overlapping,
you
know?
Yeah. And not just with, say religious thinkers and figures like,
you know, or Buddha, guess, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah,
the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama. Mm-hmm. You know, you could think about is what Confucius is doing philosophy? I would say definitely yes. It's much more politically oriented. Right? Mm-hmm. So I think, there isn't like a neat dividing line. Or the people make dividing lines, right? They're like, here's where philosophy is, here's where theology is, and here's the border crossing.
Yeah.
And you always got to ask them, well, first off, are you making that distinction from the side of philosophy or from theology?
Ooh,
you
know, who's
laying down the line? And then how did you put it right there? You know,
that's
because,
deep.
Because the next guy over isn't putting the line right there. He's got it over here instead. So which of you are right?
Yeah.
You
know? Boy, Dr. Sadler, what I said to you earlier, the regular man and the esteemed professor just came out in what you just said there, because you just really posed a deep thought with very practical terms, and I love that a lot. But listen, so now let me move on to something a little bit. I'm gonna probably put you on the spot a little bit here, maybe. So let's see here. I was just kind of checking the time here. So I want to ask about these four philosophers you've already mentioned, and just maybe ask you to offer us, you know, if you can, one thing that you would say either they represented or spoke about that would give us something to learn about and live with. So I want to ask you about Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and Epictetus. You know, so what did Socrates present to us that gives us something to live by, to work with?
One of the consistent things with Socrates is his emphasis on prioritization. He goes around to all of his fellow Athenians and he says, you're paying so much attention to like your career or your social status or your property or your body, and you're not engaging in care of the soul, who you are, you know, the person that you, because you can lose your possessions, but if you're a miserable bastard, you're bringing that with you no matter where you go. Right. And so Socrates was really stressing that what we ought to be prioritizing is whatever you want to call it. It could be the soul, the personality, the me,
the being.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, he was saying we should take a look at this. We should try to come up with some standards for figuring out whether we're doing good or doing badly. You know, being rich, you can be rich, but also a terrible person, or you can be miserable. So what makes us actually happy or well off? I would say that is, I mean, there's a lot of other things that he says.
I can imagine. Right? Yeah. That's why I thought I would put you on the spot. There's so many different directions. But isn't that even like wildly true today with, let's call it the great resignation, where people are saying, yeah, man, what is this all about? You know, maybe life is more important than status and money and corporate America and whatever.
That's a great example. And I think that part of what's going on in the great resignation is that people are saying, you know, I bought into this for a while and I was willing to try it out, but it's not as if the economy is going to like love me or reward me or something like that. I'm going to find something else that really matters to me instead, you know, like maybe my kids, you know, spending more time with them, or, I don't know, writing a book or whatever it happens to be.
I love that.
Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, please.
Three, do you mind if I focus them?
You do it exactly the way that you'd like to, please.
Well, I mentioned that, you know, I do a lot of work on anger, and all three of those people have some really great insights about anger. One of the key ideas that Plato brings across is that we get angry with other people very often when we disagree about key matters. And then we feel like, you know, they're being jerks or they're stupid, and, you know, we get all riled up about it. And those key ideas are things like the just and the unjust, or what's useful and what's harmful, or this wide range of things that the Greeks called the beautiful or the fine or the honorable or the opposite of that. And in the Euthyphro, Plato has Socrates and Euthyphro say that not only do the human beings disagree and get angry with each other and hate each other over these things, the gods do as well, you know.
Interesting.
So I think that's a usable thing. We, you know, when we find ourselves in conflict with other people, we clearly have different values, and it's very easy to become angry with them because we're like, who the hell are you to view things that way, right? And so we can be on guard against that. With Aristotle, he has a very sophisticated treatment of anger. You might have, you know, if you've ever read Daniel Goleman's Emotional Intelligence, it begins with that Aristotle quote about it's easy to get angry, but getting angry, and then he lists off all these different criteria with the right people at the right time to the right amount. That's something that's quite very actionable, right? You can like get into a situation. You know how you sometimes like you're angry with your boss, you vent on your fellow employee, or you go home and, you know, yell at somebody else. Well, that's the wrong people, right?
right.
Wrong amount. You know, you can ask yourself, I'm ticked off about something. Does it really deserve this amount of affect? You know?
Boy, I love that.
Epictetus has a really great, he talks a lot about anger because the Stoics weirdly were kind of zero tolerance, anger is never any good. And I don't really agree with them on that, but.
Can you just explain a little bit about what Stoicism is, just a little bit so that, you know.
Yeah. That's probably really helpful because we often talk about lowercase s Stoicism, which is like the disposition of stiff upper lip and not showing emotions, maybe repressing them. And that's not Stoic philosophy.
Okay.
Uppercase s Stoic philosophy. It teaches you how to like understand your emotions and rework them and try to get rid of some of the negative ones, but keep the positive ones like love or affection or, you know, proper caution and thing, joy, you know, is another thing. And the Stoics were a major, school that was originally kind of eclectic. The founder drew upon three different schools and brought them together into a synthesis and then developed his own stuff. And then there's like additional developments after that, all the way down to the time of the Roman Empire, where we have like Seneca and Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius, the emperor himself representing it. And, you know, it's been in and out of vogue throughout history. There was a huge interest in Stoicism in the early modern period. all the way up to like maybe the 19th century, and then it kind of goes into decline. And in the 20th century, towards the end of it, it's become really big. And so now, you know, there's like probably at least a couple million people practicing Stoicism worldwide.
You know? What would you do then, Greg, if you were practicing Stoicism? What is sort of the central theme, if there is one, behind that?
If I had to pick just one idea, and this would be something that's not unique to Stoicism, but is common to a lot of different philosophies of life, it would be that we have some capacity to intervene in whatever habits or programming or whatever you want to call it that we've got. So we can rationally decide to make ourselves into better and happier and, you know, better adjusted people. But we, you know, it's difficult. There's a lot of different ways to do it, right?
Wow, man, that's deep. I have never heard that before. I mean, great study, but that's, I love that.
Well, it's really liberating for people, I think, to hear that, because we often feel like, you know, I've got my thoughts, I've got my background, I've got my feelings, and I'm stuck with them. I can't do anything about it, right? But I mean, Stoicism would say, okay, you're angry all the time. That's something that you could like figure out what's going on with. Why are you angry all the time? Why does the same thing keep happening to you? What can you change in the ways that you look at things so that you're not, you know, automatically going down this thought process?
Wow, that's fascinating. My ego needs to clarify something in that.
Sure.
I had never heard that that's what Stoicism was about, was this, that concept. It's fascinating. I mean, I think I probably did have sort of the small s and the large s a little bit more confused about it. That's fascinating. It makes me want to go look more at Stoicism now about this, because that's what Grow Yourself is all about, you know, that we are capable of changing it.
Exactly.
Yes, and it's hard.
I think there's a lot of people who don't think that they're capable of change, right? And so that's an initial thing to overcome. And, you know, people... like I said, it is liberating. People hear that and they're like, oh crap, I actually don't have to feel like crap all the time.
Man, that's fascinating, you know? And this brings me to, and I'm going to ask you in a minute how people can find you, but I'm going to set us up for, we can't get out of another episode here, because I just thought of what we should talk about, what I want to hear you talk about. And that is the concept of, you remember when I asked, you know, what do philosophers do? One of the things that I try to bring out in that little sort of lesson is that they really ask good questions. You know, that, you know, when you think about, you know, Socratic dialogues and all these other sorts of things. And this leads me to believe, now hearing what you said about Stoicism, is that one of the places that I've learned that we can start to change ourselves is by asking simple questions, you see. And so I would love it if maybe our next go round could be talking about the very idea of asking questions of ourselves. You know, I don't know if maybe Socrates actually asked this question, but I had read it somewhere. It could be true, not true, but it's still, there could be some profoundness around this.
Yeah.
And I would bring up this thing that, you know, Socrates would ask, why does the leaf fall from the tree? Why does the leaf fall from the tree? And when I first heard that, and even when I introduced it to maybe people I'm talking to, they're kind of go, what? But then I start thinking, man, really think about that question for a second, and you will start to go deep trying to answer why that actually happens, which is only sort of an idea that we present, that the questions can take you into a deeper level of thinking and understanding, and therefore growth, in my opinion.
I think that's right. I don't know if he actually did ask that one. That one doesn't come to mind.
I have no idea.
But, but you know, it's a good question, because you could steer it in different directions. Like, you could have somebody could come along and they're like, well, the leaf falls from the tree, and they give this scientific explanation for
correct.
Like, you know, there's like a drying that takes place, and I don't even know the mechanics of it, but, you know, and then somebody else could be like, well, they fall from the tree, so that, you know, they give me work to do. Or they could have another sort of teleological explanation, well, they fall from the tree to provide cover for the things that are growing underneath it, you know, like bumblebees and stuff like that, right? And so there's like, I don't know, who knows how many potential directions that one question
could
could happen with, like, why are you angry? Right?
There it is. I was just going to say exactly the same thing. You start with that question. Why am I so angry?
Yeah. And then that can like lead off into all these different directions. I will mention something. I got tasked by Marquette University to take on three classes this current semester. And two of them are this like upper level capstone core class. That's a new class. And it's supposed to be like problem oriented. So, you know, it could be about racism, or it could be about the economy, or it could be about, you know, COVID protocols and stuff like that. And I, you know, we'll see whether they like me doing this or not. It's one of those things where I'm gonna, instead of asking permission, I might have to apologize later.
Yeah,
exactly. But I'm focusing it on anger. And anger within our society. So I'm going to work with these, you know, roughly 20 to 24 year olds, thinking about what resources we can take from philosophy to understand our own anger, to understand other people's anger, to change some of these things ourselves, and maybe figure out when it's okay to be angry in terms of working for justice.
Wow. That's fascinating. No, I congratulate you for even thinking about going down that direction, because, you know, there, as you say it, you know, tools and resources and ideas that we can draw on from some of the great philosophers that really in some ways outside of academia is lost to the average person. You know, I think that's fascinating.
Yeah. And with anger, it's unfortunate because we don't get much helpful learning about it in, you know, K through 12, unless you screw up, right? Mm-hmm. And then they'll send you to a counselor. Mm-hmm. And then as adults, we get almost nothing about it, mm-hmm. except for bad examples, unless you really screw up, and then you're mandated to do anger management, right? Yeah. But that's only for like the people who've really gone off the edge and got themselves into enough trouble that somebody else can boss them around and tell them they have to do that, you know? Whereas a lot of us would benefit from, I mean, it doesn't have to be just philosophy. We can, there's lots of resources in psychology and some in literature and things like that for understanding it. But we don't do it, unfortunately. And we don't do it with really any of our emotions. We don't teach people how to handle love and romantic, you know, desire and stuff like that very well. We don't do it with grief very well, I think.
So, I would agree with that. Yes. Yeah. And so many, you know, boy, what a timely subject that could be, having really practical and strong conversations around grief, because, you know, just with the last couple of years, I've personally, and my wife and many others around me, have experienced some serious grief, you know, from COVID and those sorts of things. Well, listen, I mean, wow, just this was, you know, so great to have this conversation. May I just ask, Greg, can you tell folks, and I have your links, but I'd love for you to tell folks where they can go read your works or your book. I know you have a book, and you know, just where people can find you.
Well, I will say this. I'm very fortunate in that although there are other Gregory Sadlers out there, if you type in Gregory Sadler into Google, all sorts of my stuff will come up.
I've seen it.
So, you know, it's gotta be kind of hell for the other Gregory Sadlers who are trying to.
Yeah, but the heck with them if they can't take a joke, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But that's one way people can do that. The book that I've written a book called Reason Fulfilled by Revelation, the 1930s Christian Philosophy Debates in France, that was published in 2011. And that's, you know, it's translations of documents. And then I have a long historical introduction, and it might not be to everybody's taste. And it's kind of expensive too. It's like $75. So it's priced out of the casual reader range. But I did recently with a co-editor edit Stoicism Today Selected Writings Volume 3, which are some of the best entries from the blog, and we're actually working on Volume 4, which is going to be coming out in just a couple months.
Is so that on Amazon or?
It is. As a matter of fact, we self-published on Amazon and the funds from it go to support the Modern Stoicism organization.
How cool is that?
Yeah, it's quite nice. And my colleagues at Modern Stoicism are all great people. I mean, I have a podcast, Sadler's Lectures, that people can easily just Google that. There's the video channel, of course.
You're putting a lot of content out there.
I should mention, I am on Medium, and the piece that you were mentioning about my dad, that's on there. I haven't been that great about getting written content out because I'm more focused on video and podcast stuff.
Yeah.
But I do want to do more writing.
Yeah. You know? I want to encourage you to keep writing about your dad and that stuff. It's really good stuff. I mean, it's one of those, really it is. It's one of those writings that it's interesting to read about it, but there's lessons along the way that, you know, that I just picked up on, you know, as a dad, you know, and thinking about your, you know, my dad who just passed last year as well, you know, I mean, it's more than just reading an interesting understanding of you growing up and your father. There's really some good lessons in there. It's a short piece. I really encourage people. All of that will be in the show notes. Dr. Greg Sadler, I look forward to our next podcast.
Me
I'm gonna
too.
Hold you to it. You know, I'm gonna bug you if you get too busy on me, you know, because I'd love to have some more discussions with you.
Yeah, I look forward to that. And so, I really enjoyed this conversation.
The pleasure is completely mine. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And thanks for having me on.
My pleasure.